today's Dhamma talk with an apology because I'm not sure how clear or lucid it's going to be, but I'm going to try. First of all, we're going to take the precepts. And always good to recollect what we're doing when we do this ceremony. So we're recommitting to a process or a training. So these precepts are a training. It's actually very difficult to keep them purely, especially in the area of speech, many people will know. It's not telling lies, it's not just not telling lies, this musawada, it's also a harsh speech, a frivolous speech, white lies, exaggerations, all the stuff that we do around speech. So when we come to take the precepts, we wipe the slate clean and we start again, and we recommit to, we understand that these rules, these five precepts, are what the Buddha recommends as a foundation for successful meditation, a foundation for feelings of well-being. And we have a look, how have we been going? How have we been going on them? So are we killing beings? Have we killed any beings, or are we being violent or aggressive towards beings? Taking that which is not given, are we only taking that which is given freely? Where are we with our the second precept? Sexual misconduct, I try to think of this in terms of being responsible with sexuality. So are we being responsible, are we being careful in this area? And the speech, as I was talking about, and then intoxication, where are we with intoxication? Very difficult in Australian culture, alcohol is everywhere. Just noticing yesterday how all of the Woolworths have the Woolworths supermarket, and right next to it is Woolworths. And that's a new thing. I mean, it's probably been happening for a few years, but I just noticed it yesterday, that liquor is everywhere. So there's a lot of social pressure to drink. I think it's, if possible, it really is better not to at all, ever. And for a few reasons. One reason is, if you want to feel confident about your Buddhist practice, this is something you can do which gives you a feeling of confidence. This is not always understood, that if we're keeping these precepts in a really squeaky clean way, we can feel confident. And then we can feel confident about our respect for the Buddha as well. If we offer this to the Buddha out of respect, so there is the mind that says half a glass with dinner is okay. Okay, it's true, probably isn't too bad, that's true. But what we're doing is we're justifying doing something that we want. But if we say, okay, I'm going to give up that half a glass because I respect the Buddha and I respect his teachings, and I want the confidence and the dignity and the well-being that comes from knowing that I've surrendered to this training wholeheartedly, you probably get more well-being and more happiness if you can forsake the half a glass. The other thing about the half a glass is it often becomes two glasses, I know. So once you've had a few sips and it's very pleasant and the people around you are drinking as well. So sometimes it's just really nice to have that very clear line. And then you have the happiness that comes from having pure ethical conduct and knowing that you've surrendered to this training in a sincere way. Intoxication isn't just the drink and the drugs. It's good to have a look at what we do with these big screens, how much time we spend in front of them. And this one's off, so that's okay. I heard someone told me there's a famous monk in Taiwan who has a TV station, which apparently has a couple of million viewers, and apparently this monk is quite gifted in samadhi. Apparently Mara appeared to him in his meditation and said, "What are you doing using my tool?" Apparently Mara was upset about this. But it's interesting, isn't it? If Mara considers the television to be his tool, well then, there's probably something. Intoxication can be just allowing the mind to be lost, allowing the mind to be dull. So that's a kind of an intoxication. And so I guess work all day, you probably need to relax a bit. It's okay to watch a little bit of TV, but it's like show some discernment, some discrimination. What are we watching? The problem, of course, is like once you're there on the lounge chair and you're having some chips and whatever, nuts or whatever, and you are relaxed and the mindfulness isn't so clear and the things in your hand, the control. So then it's very easy to look at what's the next thing and then the next thing and the next thing, and then you're going to bed with a very dull mind. So that's to be avoided if possible. With the TV, like watching only what is useful or consciously relaxing, but then kind of putting a limit to it. That after you've relaxed, you're going to go and do something skillful. Perhaps even more challenging, more dangerous now is the internet. So I don't use it very much myself, but I know that when one is using it, that time seems to go very fast. And when you can read about the particular thing that you're interested in. And also the stuff around pornography is very dangerous, actually. So to be careful what you expose your mind to. Ask yourself, are you nourishing wholesome dhammas or are you nourishing unwholesome dhammas? So just because we like something doesn't mean it's good for us. And it's the same with news. So we can get kind of fascinated with news. It's a very engrossing. But how much do we actually need to know? Sometimes watching too much news, it can be depressing. We can also become very self-righteous. And we can end up feeling despairing when you lose your sense of trust in human beings and all these kind of things. So keeping the amount of news at the right amount, and keeping the entertainment at the right amount, keeping distraction at the minimum. So that's the point, I think, of that precept around intoxication, is that we're trying not to be lost, trying not to be distracted, trying to maintain a focus in our life. Refuge. Thank goodness we have these refuges. The Buddha. So the Buddha was the proof that there's something much more in life in terms of our potential. There is a state completely beyond dukkha in all of its manifestations. That's pretty amazing. And we glimpse this when we have those moments of peacefulness, we have insights, we do glimpse what it's like to have an absence of dukkha. All Buddhist practitioners will be experiencing that in moments to some degree. And the Buddha is symbolic of someone who's gone completely beyond all forms of dukkha, transcended, liberated. So that's amazing. So the Buddha is a refuge of that historical being. It's also a refuge of our potential. So we understand that the Buddha started as a deluded being, someone deeply affected by greed, hatred and ignorance. And through training himself, he became the Buddha. And then the Buddha had this capacity to explain reality. And this is our problem, is that we don't perceive reality correctly. All unenlightened beings are ignorant. And because of ignorance, we're deluded. Because of delusion, we don't perceive things correctly. So the Buddha explained things more correctly in a lot of detail and in many different ways. So we have a better way of understanding the conventional reality, and then we have a training which leads to directly perceiving and then transforms the mind. At least the conscious experience is transformed to a state beyond suffering if we live according to the truth. So this is a very important principle. When we take refuge in Dhamma, we're taking refuge in truth, in ultimate truth. And then when we're training in the precepts, the Dhamma also includes the path that we cultivate and that we live in accordance with so that we might realize that truth. So that's training in the precepts, training in meditation, being generous. And then Sangha is refuge. All of those people who have practiced correctly since the time of the Buddha and have realized the same result. This is also incredibly encouraging. It's not just this very special being that comes around every few eons. We're in this eon. Apparently there will be five. One more to come, this eon. It's not just the Buddha that gets liberated. It's anyone who follows that training. And so even today, I believe in this world, we have people who are liberated, free from suffering, experiencing that state. Sangha also includes, so that's the highest end of Sangha, people who have actually realized the training. Sangha also includes those who are practicing correctly. So that someone who's keeping the precepts, meditating a lot, and that's also your lay friends, your good lay friends, that's your lay sangha. Monks and nuns who are putting in a fair effort, and those are also sangha. And people who put on robes that aren't really training themselves, didn't have a good intention to become a monk or a nun, that's not sangha. So sangha is people who are cultivating mindfulness, cultivating wisdom, cultivating samadhi on that foundation of ethics. This is your sangha. And those people who've realized the result of practicing in that way, that's the sangha. So I just like every now and then to go over those refuges and those precepts so that when we do this ceremony, we do it with some understanding. And we're resetting that intention to continue to train ourselves. And we're holding this up as a mirror in a way. Where am I with these five precepts and the principles that they highlight? How am I going with these five precepts? And how deeply am I taking refuge? So, wanted to talk today a little bit about the four Brahmavihara, and sometimes called divine emotions or the highest emotions. So these are among wholesome qualities. These are the extreme end of wholesome mental qualities, emotional qualities. One of the reasons I like to talk about it is often a lot of what we're experiencing, a lot of our attitudes aren't based in these qualities. So when we consciously recognize that these are attitudes, these are qualities that are wholesome, skillful, again, I use the word a mirror. This holds a mirror to what's functioning in the mind, what's present in the mind. But not only does it hold a mirror to it, this is the wonderful thing about the Brahmaviharas, is it gives us an option. Now, something that can be observed about our culture, but not just our culture, perhaps modern life, is people seem to become quite seriously affected by cynicism, suspicion. We become somewhat hardened, and the way we're educated and the way media works, we become very critical. We're all very good critics. We become very fault-finding. And so if this is pervasive in a culture, we might not even notice it. It's just like that's what you do. You complain a bit. You say what's wrong about the government. You say what's wrong with the economic policies, and you say what's wrong with the immigration policy and the environment policy and whatever. We can all grumble about lots of things, and it's not to say that there aren't things that are wrong. It's just to notice, to ask the question, is indulging these kind of thoughts and acting from this attitude helpful or skillful? And is it going to help us to be happy people? Is it going to help us to have some samadhi? Is it going to help us to develop wisdom? So the divine abidings, these emotions, starts as thoughts and then becomes an emotion. I'm going to read a definition that I found on the Dhamma Encyclopedia. Something that definition doesn't say, which I think is very important, is that it becomes samadhi. These four qualities, when held in the mind with right intention and with skillful effort, become a very powerful form of concentration. And so if we can train ourselves to hold any four of these qualities in the mind, that means that other qualities are not present in the mind at that time. So it's like we might know that we're a bit cynical, we might know that we're critical, we might even know that we have a habit of withholding kindness towards ourselves, but we might not feel that we can do anything about it. We just kind of know that. And this is part of the, I'd say, the problem of the modern world. And I was attending a talk recently, in America actually, by a lay teacher, who, a Tibetan, grew up in a very traditional, religious, Buddhist family, surrounded by other Tibetan Buddhists. But then went and studied in England and got a couple of degrees. I think he has his Geshe degree from one of those Tibetan monasteries, but he also has a PhD in psychology and a PhD in comparative religion or whatever. Anyway, he studied lots of things, and I was interested in his perspective. what he was talking about Western culture, he was saying that he just gave one example. He said when it comes to psychopathology, when it comes to knowing the various things that can be wrong with people psychologically, there's this manual which is this thick, this thing, everything that's wrong. I think it's called the DPSM, and DPSM-4, and they're just about to come out with a DPSM-5, which is probably going to be thicker. And so, but then he said when it comes to like real manuals that you can grasp, which outline things which are good, things that you can do to stimulate wholesome mindsets, things that you can do to be happy, he said you can't really point to anything. There's no manual that we look to. There's no standard that we look to as modern people that's like, this is how you go about being happy. This is how you go about having a healthy mind. And well, I thought that was very revealing about our culture. But this is something that intelligence in the head tends to kind of discriminate. That's very good at knowing what's wrong. So our culture's cultivated that a lot. Now this does have some advantages, but it needs to be in perspective. The Brahmaviharas is emotional, isn't it? It's in the heart. So we train our thoughts. We train our thoughts. If suppose you want to cultivate loving kindness, we start with the wish, may I be well, may I be happy. It's a thought. May all beings be well, may all be happy. But then we're trying to stimulate a blossoming of an emotion in the heart center. So this is bringing us, it starts with the head, but it's bringing us down into the heart. Similarly with compassion, may I be free from suffering, may all beings be free from suffering. With compassion we're trying to feel with or empathize with the suffering of ourselves and of others. So this, again, it's coming into the center, and it's not looking at why there's a problem and why there shouldn't be a problem and who should be doing something about the problem. It's going underneath that to the central fact of suffering and then responding with something wholesome. I'll talk a little bit more about that now, and I'll mention now that next Saturday's workshop is going to have compassion as the main theme, if anyone's interested. I'm going to do a bit more work there. Mudita, incredibly helpful. Empathic joy, sympathetic joy. Now this is a wonderful antidote to cynicism, sarcasm, suspiciousness. This is where we train ourselves, we force ourselves to notice what's okay about ourselves and good, and about our situation and our life, and also that in others. So this is a very good and powerful tool. And then equanimity. Equanimity is actually very profound. We tend to think that equanimity is nothing, or we think it's indifference. Equanimity is more like understanding things the way they are. Because of having a very good understanding of the things as the way they are, one can remain in a state of equipoise or a state of perfect balance, serenity. So it's actually it's a powerful emotion which is neither moving towards or moving away from, but it's an emotion with an incredible amount of clarity and stillness and balance. So equanimity is a wonderful thing. And so the thing I think I just want to hold up to remind us all, or remind myself too, is that there are these powerful tools that we have. So if we have which we can train our mind with. So we have our habits, and then we can, in this mental training, we can choose to train the mind in a different way. So we have our social conditioning, and we have the way that society affects us. And then at a certain point, as a Buddhist, Buddhism is a religion, a philosophy, a science for people who want to take responsibility. The Buddha says that he only points the way, and that we have to walk that way. So it's a religion for grown-up people, people who want to take responsibility. So at a certain point, we decide that we're going to train ourselves, whether the people around us are behaving skillfully or not. We are going to train our own minds to become more wholesome and lay that foundation for developing insight. So I'll just read this definition. The four Brahmaviharas are considered by Buddhism to be the four highest emotions. The word Brahma literally means highest or superior. It is also the name given to the Supreme God in Hinduism during the Buddha's time. Vihara means to dwell, to live or to abide. Thus, the Brahmaviharas are not emotions one occasionally feels, but that one lives in and lives by all the time. So that's what we would aspire for. That would be the result. Like any emotion, any mental habit, the more the mind becomes acquainted with it, the more the mind takes on the qualities of that habit. So just like we might have a suspicious tendency, a cynical tendency, a self, an angry towards oneself habit, if we train ourselves in responding in these ways, in cultivating these as attitudes, one is able to abide in these attitudes. This is it's not something that one that can just do, so that's the one thing I'm not so... one just by understanding this concept doesn't mean that one can do it. But we understand the potential, that as people being generous and practicing with precepts and meditating, that we can, through meditating skillfully, become habituated to abide in these attitudes most of the time. I really think that is the result of Buddhist training. And these four Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, empathic joy, and equanimity, can be understood from several different perspectives, as four related but not separate qualities, or perhaps as four different ways the spiritually mature person relates to others according to their situation. So they are mature ways to relate to oneself and others. So most modern people think a lot. And so in our meditation, I think it's a good thing to learn to use thought. So when you come to your cushion and you find that you're thinking a lot, well then we can pick up these phrases and these words, or we can even contemplate for a while why it's helpful to have loving kindness. We can look at the drawbacks of being grumpy, getting angry, holding on to grudges, and we can look at the benefits, you know, just using your own contemplative faculty, look at the benefits of thinking with loving kindness, and then we come to a sense, yes, loving kindness is wholesome, skillful, valuable. We have to understand ourselves, we have to want to have success in meditation, you have to see the value of what you're meditating on, and you have to like really bring that into your heart with sincerity. So we actually spend a minute or two contemplating. You know, the Buddha says loving kindness is really valuable, really helpful. Is it? So you can ask yourself. Because if you just come and you sit and you think, may I be well, may I be happy, you know, it might not happen. You might not get much of a response. But if you really recollect why loving kindness is valuable, what is it the antidote to, what does it balance in the mind, what's the result? And from the experiences that you've had where loving kindness meditation has been effective, what was the result? Did you feel happier? Was the mind brighter? Was it more spacious? Was there an absence of habitual heaviness or hardness or darkness? And then you think, yeah, okay, I agree. Loving kindness is wholesome, skillful, valuable. And then we use our thought, may I be well, may I be happy. Another thing we can do is we could ask, well, what does it mean? What would it mean to be well? I like to encourage people to invest these words with special meaning. So you can spend some time contemplating, what would it mean to me to be well? It might mean that I can, partly it might mean that I have three espressos a day instead of four, and that I spend 1 hour on the internet instead of five, and that I get my credit debt, that I only have one maxed credit card, that, you know, for you, what would it mean to be well? You know, it means we want to do a little bit better than we're doing so that we have more well-being. And then so when you say this, may I be well, you really wish that. You know, may I make skillful decisions? May I maintain healthy disciplines? May I abandon that which isn't skillful? That's what it means to wish yourself well. So you can spend a couple of minutes and then be careful here not to, when you do that, not to get too far out of the contemplation, start just proliferating too much. You just want to establish a sense of sincerely applying oneself to the meditation, seeing the value of it. And then, may I be well, may I be happy? And then hopefully opening the heart, some warmth, some love, really. It's kind of goodwill, unconditional love, and just aiming that in the heart and then opening that up and then just allowing that and using the breath, breathing in, may I be well, breathing out, may I be happy, and just allowing it to abide there in the body. And then we train in radiating it outwards. When we train in this way, we train at first with people who it's easy to have loving kindness towards, so we bring them to mind. And breathing in, may I be well, breathing out, you actually picture that person or get a feeling, not everyone's visual, just get a feeling for that person being there. And radiate that warmth out towards them. You don't try to send your mind, if it's your long lost friend who's in London, you don't try to send your mind to London. That's too exhausting. You just try to bring that person to you. And there's a sense of don't send the mind too far away, just keep it there and feel confident that person's there. The thing about mind that's very interesting is it's not bound to space and time in the same way that bodies are. I've heard many stories of people, even though they were on the other side of the world, feeling it something when people radiated loving kindness towards them or when they dedicated merit towards them. So you can feel confident that if your loving kindness meditation really has some integrity, that it will affect people in a positive way. The near enemy to, I just wanted to talk about the near and far enemies. The near enemy to loving kindness is affection. So this is something to be careful of. So when there's affection, there's attachment. So loving kindness is goodwill. It's not a grasping at the being. It's just wishing them well. So the next step in the loving kindness meditation is that we move on to neutral beings. This is actually very important if we want to take it on as a discipline. We radiate loving kindness to neutral people. So that might bring to mind the cleaning lady that we hardly ever talk to, but that we know, or the gardener, or the taxi driver. You know, all of those Indian taxi drivers, may they be well, may they be happy. Just people that you don't know personally, but that you see, may they be well, may they be happy. And then we train in really being able to hold more of these people who are not in the category of our friends, those who we're close to, those who we habitually have contact with. We train the mind in actually being able to offer this attitude to more and more beings. Then we start to include those that it's difficult to have loving kindness for. So once we can maintain the thoughts in a focused way, and then it becomes a wholesome feeling, and then that wholesome feeling really gets some power, it's then possible to aim that at even people who we would usually find it very difficult to have loving kindness towards. And that again is really helpful in having the meditation not being affected by the near enemy of affection. Is if we can train ourselves to having loving kindness even for people who suppose have hurt us, or have hurt people that we know, or who are hurting people now, or who are making really stupid decisions which affect us all badly, that we can radiate loving kindness towards that person. It doesn't mean that we don't understand what is conventionally skillful or not skillful. It just means that we truly wish people well. And in fact, if people were well, they wouldn't be doing the unskillful things that they do. So we actually wish that may they be well, may they be happy. Ill will is the far enemy of loving kindness. So again, when we habituate the mind to this, we'll probably notice when those feelings of ill will come up, because they actually want to hurt somebody. Okay, well then you know, okay, that's definitely not loving kindness, that's the far enemy. Sometimes before we meditate, we might not have even noticed how often we have these little moments. And we begin to meditate and we realize, oh, even though I'm a fairly nice person, every now and then I want to kill somebody. And it is important to become truthful about that and become aware of it, because we all have that potential, actually. It is, you know, I think the prisons are full of people who many people made one bad mistake. And we tend to get this image in our mind, murderers, you know, bad people. But it might have just been the case that people were pushed into a painful corner and lost their temper and ended up in jail with this word murderer. We actually all have this potential. If we're in enough pain, if we don't have enough mindfulness, we can all end up being the murderer in jail. So very important to become very mindful of these things, very important to be cultivating their antidotes, weakening the tendency towards this quality and deepening the tendency towards other qualities. Compassion, also a subtle quality, very profound. Compassion is feeling with suffering. At the same time, one isn't distressed. Now this is tricky. And this is why it's a type of samadhi. Because if it wasn't samadhi, we wouldn't be able to maintain that center with an integrity. So it starts as thoughts, but it's important to know what it is. Compassion, when it's really functioning, what is it like? So it isn't pity. In pity, that's the near enemy, by the way. The near enemy to compassion is pity. Pity is where there's an us, someone there, feeling sorry for that person. So there's too much self in that. And where forgetting, if we're feeling pity, we're forgetting that we are still in this samsaric story, we're still in the situation where we might be that person. So it might be the case, you know, you feel sorry for the starving Ethiopians, but, you know, what if we run out of petrol and we can't get, you know, and there's no food in the supermarket, then we're going to be the starving Australians. It's like really possible. So it's, you know, we understand that any of us could all of a sudden be in a situation with very coarse suffering. Unfortunately, this is part of our samsaric predicament. So compassion is aware that human beings, all conscious beings not yet liberated, are prone to, vulnerable to, terrible suffering. And so it's a feeling with, and responding with, wishing that it was otherwise, and even wishing to do something about it, and yet not being distressed. Now this is tricky. You don't take on the suffering as your personal suffering. You just really wish it was otherwise. So if there isn't some samadhi there, it's not actually possible. And I think loving kindness is a little easier to do than compassion. And doesn't get mentioned very much in Theravada Buddhism, actually, compassion. But it's tricky. To really have compassion is requires a lot of maturity. And that area of knowing, it's understanding that it's not pity, and that it's not about taking on the suffering. It is about wanting to do something and actually doing something if you can. But then there needs to be a certain amount of equanimity, as these qualities balance each other. It's a set of four emotions, and equanimity is very important. It plays a role in making sure that metta really is metta. There isn't that affection there. Goodwill, impartial goodwill, there's some equanimity there. That compassion isn't pity, and that we're not falling into a state of misery because of the suffering in the world. That actually, even if you have a lot of compassion, in that moment, you'll be, part of the mind will be very serene, very peaceful, if it's real compassion. And yet, you really want to do something to make there be less suffering in your experience and other beings' experience. And if you're capable, you will. Mudita, sympathetic joy, empathic joy, that's feeling good, genuinely feeling good about the good fortune that you have and that others have. This is a really good thing to do if you find that you're depressed, if you find that you're just grumpy, you find you're negative, you find you couldn't be bothered. So we all find ourselves in that state. At times, you come to your meditation, you can ask yourself, okay, what is it in my life that I could feel good about? And if it's really bad, you'll think, nothing. And that's something that you shouldn't believe. Very important here to have perspective. And we need to have this samsaric perspective. It's like, if you have food on the table today, you're a person of extraordinary good fortune. Because I think about 70% of the planet is malnourished. So it's like we forget this. We forget when we live in our suburban worlds. We forget that most beings on the planet are struggling just to get enough to eat. And then if you live in a place where you're not confronted with very coarse violence on a daily level, you're very fortunate. Because there's lots of parts of the world where little children grow up playing with guns. The guns are so pervasive in cultures, particularly South America, Africa, parts of Russia. There's so many guns around, and parts of rural America. And violence, children see from childhood, and people are confronted with. Inner cities in America, there's a lot of violence around from early childhood. So if you're a person who's not experiencing threats to your life on a daily basis, you're very fortunate. We forget this, we completely forget it. Although it's on the news and we see it, we tend to forget it, it's somewhere else. We don't realize the incredible benevolence that we're currently experiencing. So having food, having relative safety, okay, this is a result of merit. So this is the thing that you can rejoice in. You can rejoice in the fact that you're experiencing the results of having lived with virtue, having not been violent, having been generous. Well, that's why you have enough food on the table, and that's why you're not being confronted with violence daily. But you have to do some work. First of all, you have to recognize the good fortune. There's an enormous amount of good fortune here. I'm not recognizing it. I'm going to challenge my depression, going to challenge my cynicism. Where's the good fortune? Your physical health. having a, I mean, you can always complain about the healthcare system, but it's one of the best in the world, in Australia. So it's recently in America. In America, you have to have insurance, and when you get your insurance policy, usually any pre-existing condition is not covered. So what that means is, like, that's not a healthcare system, is it? It means that you can be treated for any sickness you have after this point, but anything you've had before, or anything you have now where we won't cover, that's not very nice. And then a lot of people don't have any health insurance at all, and health costs in America are incredible. So you have these situations where someone loses a job, and their health care was given to them by their employers, and they're covered for 6 months after they're fired. And then all of a sudden, this person who was living this middle-class life defaults on their mortgage and has no health care. So this doesn't happen to us. We're very lucky. It's just kind of recognizing, again, there's a lot of benevolence. We can always find fault with the way things are, but the amount that is good in this culture is extraordinary. So it's like there's a lot to feel joy for. There's a lot to feel grateful for. Now, gratitude is something very similar to mudita, when one feels grateful. And it doesn't really work to say to yourself, you should feel grateful. You have to bring to mind a sense of comparison to recognize, and then gratitude is the response. When you recognize that most beings are hungry, our biggest issue is, I don't want to get fat. So we've got more, we have more suffering about feeling fat than we have about feeling hungry. Well, that's, you know, that's lots of people smiling, kind of the suburban reality. I don't like being fat either, by the way. So, well, you all stare at me after you offer the food and I feel like I have to eat it. But anyway. So sympathetic joy, that means, well, what about if someone else gets the promotion that you wanted? And this is where we have to train ourselves. If someone has done something good and is rewarded for that, that we feel happy for them. We feel happy with them. So this is the opposite of competition. Jealousy. So this is an antidote to a lot of those negative things. So we actually feel happy. Suppose you want a baby for 10 years and you didn't have one and your sister's just had her fourth boy. You feel happy for her. And maybe ask for one. Is that when things that you want happen to other people, you feel happy for them. This is a training. It doesn't happen automatically. We have to train ourselves to think in this way. But it's perfectly possible. Appreciative joy, sympathetic joy, recognizing what is good in your life and appreciating it, and seeing what is good in other people's lives, success in other people's lives, and being happy for them. And equanimity, I was talking about that a bit. I think the very best way to cultivate equanimity is meditating. Because when we meditate, we're seeing a thought as a thought and we're pulling back from it. We're seeing a feeling as a feeling and we're pulling back from it. In that process of cultivating breath meditation, and we're developing an understanding. Thoughts will arise, they'll stay for a while and they'll cease. Feelings will arise, they'll stay for a while and they'll cease. And then this is establishing equanimity. That part of the mind which is mindful and can see phenomena as they are and is not moving either towards or from, that's equanimity. So we meditate more and more and more, then equanimity is a result. Equipoise. Ajahn Sumedho uses the word serenity. Equanimity, in terms of the types of samadhi, it becomes fourth jhana. So it's a very profound quality. If one is training in jhanas, most of us aren't, but it's just nice to know where these things go. The first few jhanas, intense rapture and tranquility, and then the mind becomes deeper, more deeply peaceful, that it actually goes beyond, more deeply into peacefulness than into the rapture or the pleasure, the pure pleasure. The types of pleasure that come in samadhi is a type of pure pleasure. A deepening of samadhi is when the mind is going more and more deeply into peacefulness, so that it's not attached, it's not even holding on to the pleasure. Samadhi is more of a process of letting go of the five senses, letting go of the world, letting go of outside conditions, turning inwards. When we do that, incredible pleasure arises in the mind. And then one goes even deeper into the samadhi, into this state of equanimity. That's the fourth jhana. And so, according to what I've read and what I've discussed with my teachers, once people become sotapannas and sakadagami, so stream enterers and people who just have a couple of lives together, this fourth jhana is the foundation for purifying the last remaining defilements. It's by placing the mind in this deeply peaceful, unmoving state that the remainder of the greed and the remainder of the hatred gets starved of its nutriment. So it's a very profound quality and has a very profound role to play. And it's just nice when we're trying to kind of embrace a training and we're trying to understand the value of something, it's just nice to see where it goes. So equanimity is a very wonderful and profound thing. It will take us all a great distance if we, whatever we can do to cultivate serenity, equanimity, equipoise, mindfulness and wisdom that results in equanimity, it's very good to do as much of that as possible. So I think I've probably said enough. I did pretty good considering I have the flu. Thank you. I was just thinking, I was sitting meditation and I was thinking, I don't think this is going to come together. And what I thought was, due to the merit of these people coming to listen to Dhamma, may there be some Dhamma. So thank you. Were there any questions about the Brahma Viharas? Anything I was talking about? How many people practice loving kindness meditation? Very good. How many people practice compassion as a meditation? Okay, a few people. They're very closely related. It's very helpful to acknowledge suffering because one can open the heart of loving kindness. I often teach that we just bring to mind the very fact of suffering. And then we respond to suffering with kindness. So it is good to give compassion a little bit more attention. So hopefully some of you will come next Saturday and do a bit more work on that.
When we talk compassion, Arjuna Buddha is the person with the biggest compassion.
Yes.
Of course, he did not go to soup kitchens and fed everybody. Mm-hmm. But it's a state of mind. It's a state of mind.
It says, there's this beautiful phrase in the sutta, the Buddha's mind imbued with compassion, quivering for the sake of beings. So he did go to enormous trouble to help us. So that's an expression of the compassion. And there are examples in the suttas where the Buddha scans the world and he sees that 20 miles away there's one person who could be liberated and he walks that distance. So there are examples of his incredible compassion. But also when he was under the Bodhi tree and he was thinking, this which I've discovered is very refined, very difficult to realize. Beings won't understand it. And if I try, it will be troublesome for me and wearying. So maybe I won't. The fact that he did is compassion, isn't it? So when he was experiencing the bliss of liberation under the Bodhi tree, he didn't have to teach anybody, but he did. Started a monk's order and then a nun's order and then this huge lay following. This is all an expression of his compassion. And then when the monks were fighting in Kosambi, they're going and trying to sort out their fight and they said, this is our problem, Buddha, don't worry about it. And he admonished them three times. And most of the suttas you can see is a response, his compassion. He doesn't talk so much about compassion, but you can see the fact that he's trying to train the king, that he's trying to train the courtesan, that he's even training the prostitutes. He's incredibly compassionate. And that his order was open to beings from every caste. This at that time was profound. So his compassion was also impartial. Anyone who had the faculties and who was free of debt was able to become a monk or a nun. Pretty amazing.
State of mind, mm-hmm. rather than focusing on the action, coming after that.
Mm-hmm. But really it's coming from that, exactly. It's coming from the mind, imbued with that quality. There's that beautiful phrase, Buddho Susudo Karuna Mahanavo, the Buddha, absolutely pure with ocean-like compassion. Beautiful. Yeah. Yep.
Two questions. The one is, does compassion come relatively easily to people that have experienced personal losses or pain?
Yeah.
And secondly, what does it, I mean, I've heard this expression, compassion fatigue.
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 Okay, yeah, social workers, psychologists, yeah, nurses. I think compassion can come easier for people who have suffered. I think so. Suffering leads to a humility. Suffering can lead to a humility. It can also lead to kind of bitterness, resentment, feeling closed off, kind of a victim consciousness. But suffering can lead to a greater empathy. And as one of the quotes, I did bring something, just in case I couldn't think of anything, I brought a few quotes. Jack Kornfield says, "Compassion is the heart's response to sorrow. We share in the beauty of life and in the ocean of tears. The sorrow of life is part of each of our hearts and part of what connects us with one another. It brings with it tenderness, mercy, and an all-embracing kindness that can touch every being." Part of what connects us with one another. So if we have the insight that just like me, I'm a vulnerable and sensitive being, and right now I'm suffering, if we then have that insight, that basic insight that every single other being has this same vulnerability, this same sensitivity, and the insight of, wow, suffering is serious phenomena and has its own validity, very real to the person experiencing it, and then empathy and sensitivity. And we become aware of, okay, so what would be helpful to me in this situation and what wouldn't be helpful to me in this situation? We notice certain things are helpful, certain things aren't helpful. And then we bring that to others, with a, hopefully. So, but I do. I think that having suffered a bit is very good for being compassionate. We're less arrogant when we know that we too also suffer terribly and can suffer terribly. And then with the other thing about compassion fatigue, that would mean that there's not yet enough samadhi. So it's like not really having the energy in terms of a collectedness. Because when we have compassion in terms of samadhi, it charges up the battery, it charges up that center, this quality is there, and then it's radiated outwards. So if there isn't the samadhi, but you have to hear about this misery, and then you have to hear about that misery, and you have that misery, you become another suffering being. There isn't the clarity, there isn't the centeredness. And that's part of what happens in our culture when people, everyone specializes. So it's the social worker that has to hear about the terrible suffering day after day after day, and the nurses that have to work with the people in terrible pain day after day after day. And in a more traditional culture, you have that be kind of a shared burden, that the whole village would be somehow helping with the old ages and the death and the sorrows and the griefs. So that becomes a question of how do you, if you are someone who works in those industries, if you are someone experiencing compassion fatigue, what do you do? Many people end up doing retreats because they find that that's the best thing. The best thing to do to recharge the heart is to give yourself that kind of tension and bring the energy back inwards, have a break for a while. So people having to spend a lot of time with people who are suffering, course suffering, need to find ways to set boundaries with it and take care of themselves as well, understanding that they're one of the beings who also suffers. I think it's a good thing to do when we are suffering is to set that intention, okay, I'm going to do my best to cause as little suffering to other beings because suffering hurts. That's a good time to set the intention. I go, this is what it feels like to have been humiliated. This is what it feels like to be insulted. This is what it feels like not to be able to work. You know, we develop sensitivity to other people experiencing difficulties and set that intention to try to be a wholesome influence and not an unwholesome influence in people's lives. Then at least our suffering has some benefits.
And compassion comes easily for a person who has wisdom and understanding, rather than a person who lives among suffering, people who suffer. Because I think it is starting inside and going out, rather than coming from outside inwards.
But sometimes people who are heady, you know, wisdom and understanding, can sometimes not be very compassionate. And sometimes people who are kind of like your grassroots granny, who might not have very much intellectual understanding, may be very compassionate. So you don't necessarily need to have understanding to be compassionate.
Wisdom, I understand.
You don't necessarily need to have wisdom. It's a heart quality. Is that when you see suffering, you wish that person wasn't suffering. It's here. And if you apply your intelligence to it as well, it's good. You can train it as a discipline. But a lot of people in agrarian cultures just respond to suffering with, you know, traditional cultures respond to suffering with acts of kindness. So it's not, you don't have to have a profound understanding. You don't need to know that it's a Brahma-vihara to do it. You know, it's just, and it's a challenge for people who are too intellectual to actually really get down to what it is.
Mm-hmm. So is there any elements in mind that we can check whether we are doing reflections or justification?
You'd have to be more specific. What particular area?
No, I don't have any specific, but it's just that
the thing about justifying is there'll be a sense of self there.
Okay.
And so if there's a sense of self justifying, and it'll be an agenda, so the thing that you want to do or why you had to do the thing you had to do. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing to be a bit suspicious of. So if there's a me there, justifying, usually Buddhist reflections, the sense of self will be, in Brahma-viharas, will be very spacious and porous. So there's a particular feeling about that. May I be well, may all beings be well, may I be happy, may all beings be happy. That's very open. But if you're justifying something, you'll have a sense of, there's a sense of self there. And the thoughts won't be peaceful. So it'll be agitated. So that's kind of my experience anyway. If we're justifying something, there's a sense of agitation and there's a sense of holding. So if it's a wise reflection, there'll be a sense of spaciousness and a sense of opening. Hopefully that's helpful. Okay, I think it's time to...